You're listening to Strictly Business Podcast with Lindsay Williams.
It's Wednesday, so it's time for Wayne on Wednesday. Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at FNB Wealth and Investment in Johannesburg. Wayne, I'm just looking at my screen and I've been looking at it and staring at it and waiting for it to do something for the last couple of weeks, actually. And it's gratifyingly quiet, don't you think? I'd rather it be quiet than doing all sorts of silly things.
Yeah, look, I mean, when you look at our market, we've actually had a very strong 6 months on our market. I mean, it's up almost 10% on 6 months.
Yeah.
And so it hasn't been a bad market at all. But certainly since halfway through June, it's essentially been hovering over this, around the 80,000 level. It actually hasn't done much at all. You know, a little bit of ups and a couple of downs, but it's actually done very, very little. And I think it's waiting for U.S. inflation, essentially. And I mean, and we did have the federal speech last night, which we can talk about because that was quite important.
Mm.
But I think it's just sitting and waiting for the inflation number out of the U.S., which I think is due this week sometime.
Yeah, I think it's due tomorrow, actually.
So the markets are just marking time, essentially.
Yes, and Jerome Powell, the chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, did speak yesterday, and he said it's all about inflation, getting inflation down to target. But his words were quite soothing, and although the market didn't take off, I think the market said, thank you very much, that's what we want. We wanted a few soothing words, which sort of engender stability in the market. Is that the impression you got?
Yes, I think it was quite an encouraging speech. I mean, he was quite emphatic, you know, that the higher interest rates is having a negative effect on the economy and that inflation was coming down and he's sort of like semi-pleased with its progress. But I think equally as important is he says the risk now, the risks are balanced, whereas previously he always said the risks are to the upside. In other words, the negative side on inflation.
Yeah.
So this is the first time he said the risks have become more balanced, which is good. So that's why I think if the inflation number comes out, as you said, tomorrow, and that is lower than expected or online, or there's some positive news in that inflation number, I think that's when the markets could well take off, and our market in particular.
When you have a look at that inflation number, there's always two sides to an inflation number. There's the demand side and the supply side. When it comes to America, and people keep on talking about the U.S. economy slowing down, so therefore the demand side is slowing down. So it depends with how you look at it, really. If the demand side of the inflation equation is diminishing, that means that they should cut interest rates in order to stimulate that demand. So if you're an optimist, you get it both sides of the argument, and they both service your purposes.
Yeah. Now, in America, the inflation is demand-led.
Mm.
And you can just see that in the wage rates, et cetera. It's very much demand-led. South Africa's completely opposite. Yeah, we've got supply-side inflation. We've got electricity prices, rates and taxes, medical aid, the imported cost of petrol, the imported cost of all the stuff we import, because there's no demand in South Africa.
No.
You know, so ours is completely different. And I often get asked, you know, if inflation has gone up because the petrol price has gone up and because Eskom has gone up, et cetera, how can interest rates bring down? How can you can't affect those prices by increasing interest rates. So therefore, you know, why are you increasing interest rates? Because inflation's high, but increasing interest rates doesn't change the price of what's causing inflation to go high. And it's a very logical argument, by the way.
It is.
For a supply side. But of course, there's some factors. First of all, it's perceptions. You know, we can't, the Reserve Bank cannot be seen to be easy on inflation because then it changes inflation perceptions. That's the first thing. The second thing is, you know, if you don't up interest rate, the rand's going to weaken. That will lead to further supply side inflation. And then thirdly, you know, if you can't control those items that's causing inflation by interest rates, you've got to suppress more and more the part of the economy that is controlled by interest rates,
which is
that
what
actually means that, you know, you must just suppress demand more to try and compensate for the higher inflation you've got in the other areas. And I think a lot of people, in fact, at my age now, the overwhelming majority of people don't understand inflation, because we've had inflation under control since the early 1990s. So we've had, you know, 30 years of controlled inflation, even though it might be higher than our trading partners. You know, in other words, our inflation is average 4 and theirs is average 2 or whatever the numbers are. But people don't understand this 15, 16% inflation. Eh? I mean, it erodes your wealth like you cannot believe. And interest rates have obviously got to be more or less equal to that to try and control inflation. I mean, you used to, in your life insurance policies, when you took them out, you sort of almost signed a clause saying my premium's going to go up 15% a year to keep track with inflation. You know, so the other than the older generation South Africans like me actually haven't experienced true high inflation. And thank goodness. And that's a very good thing.
It's interesting because it's a blunt instrument, what you've just talked about in the inflation and interest rate story, the monetary policy story, let me put it that way, in America, in South Africa, completely different. In America, you raise interest rates, everyone who's got this massive amount of debt, whether it be a mortgage or bond or credit card debt or overdraft or something, has an immediate impact on the economy. In South Africa, most people do not have an exposure to interest rates, but corporates do have an exposure to interest rates, and they are the ones that buy a new factory or something like that.
Our corporates, luckily enough for us, actually aren't all that geared. We're actually quite fortunate in that. I mean, I know there's been AutoZone and what's the other one, Westpac, that have been a bit swamped by debt, and certainly Pick and Pay is swamped by debt. Mm. And you can even maybe make an argument that Spar's got too much debt, but these are actually isolated instances. The general South African company is not overwhelmed by debt. I mean, even the property companies on COVID, they've brought down their debt levels to far more manageable levels. Even though we're in a commodity down cycle, for the first time in my experience, the mining companies didn't go crazy and conserve their cash, because they almost went bankrupt in 2014, 2015, in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. That their balance sheets are actually quite healthy for the bottom of a commodity cycle. So we don't sit with excess debt. Now, surprisingly enough, even though our government debt, I mean, I can remember when Trevor Manuel was a very good finance minister, but he had a huge amount of wind in his sails, there being the Chinese massive economic expansion between 2002 and 2008. But our debt then was 21%, 22%, 23% of GDP. I mean, now it's 80. But surprisingly enough, there's one or two, believe it or not, good things about our debt, is that we've always paid a market-related interest rate on it. You know, whereas a significant proportion of Western countries' debt was the debt issued at below 1%, you know, in the years from 2011 through to 2 years ago.
Yes.
You know, so over a 10, 11-year period, you probably find 40% of their total debt was issued at these ridiculously low interest rates. And that's got to be refinanced at some stage at interest rates 4 times higher. So surprisingly enough, on a comparative basis, our debt to GDP, I know it's, as we're an emerging market and we junk status and all of this stuff, but it's not, you know, I actually think there's a bigger problem with debt in the first world. And I mean, I've said this before, I think this is the next crisis. I don't think it's around the corner, but it's coming. You know, whether it's 5 years' time, 10 years' time, and that is these massive amounts of debts that governments carry, because we've spoken so much about interest rates going up now from the ridiculously low levels, and how the consumer wasn't squeezed and how companies weren't squeezed because they learned a lesson in the global financial crisis and actually were not overgeared. But the one part of the economy that carries enormous amount of debt are governments. And they are going to have to refinance that debt pile, as I said, at interest rates 4 times, 400% higher than what they were originally issued at.
The US,
and this is our next crisis.
The US 10-year bond yield at its lows, I think, yielded 0.6%.
Yeah.
And what is
it now?
4.3%. 4.4%,
yeah.
Exactly. I'm not saying you're wrong. Before you go on, I'm not saying you're wrong, but I've been hearing this ever since I've been a broadcaster. Well, the next thing is the big US government debt crisis because it's how many trillions that they're in debt, etc. It never happens.
No, look, I hear what you're saying, and let me give you two instances. One instance where that thought was wrong. When I started in investments, sort of really got going in investments in the early 90s, I heard about the U.S. housing market debt. And I heard that for 20 years. But it eventually came true in the global financial crisis.
Yes, it did.
It eventually was right.
Subprime.
And I think this is one of these cases. And I think this is similar. Look, U.S. debt to GDP, Japanese debt, every country except Germany, every Western, big Western economy except Germany, and even Germany's is 60-odd%, you know, they are sitting at levels never seen before because they were easily financed when long-term interest rates were 1%. In fact, in Germany, they went negative. Easily financed. So in other words, you didn't feel the squeeze at all. Previously high debts, you felt the squeeze because interest rates were always 4 to 5, long-term rates were always 4 to 5% in those countries. So this is now genuinely the first time they're looking down the barrel of a gun at refinancing these debts at significantly higher interest rates. So previously, you know, as long as your tax revenue was coming in and your interest wasn't, your interest rate, your interest payments as a percentage of your total budget didn't balloon out of control, your debt could go up, but it's gone up so rapidly and such a significant proportion of that debt has now got to be refinanced at, you know, 400% higher interest rates. Look, the U.S. bond will probably go below 4 over the next while, maybe even 3.5. But still, that's still significantly higher than what a lot of that debt was issued at. So that's our next crisis. Now, that crisis effectively may be a few countries default, but the defaults I don't think will be material. But the crisis will be governments will just simply have to tax more because, quite frankly, they can never spend less. You know, governments, doesn't matter whether you're conservative, right-wing, left-wing, you know, some governments try and spend less, but fundamentally governments can't cut expenditure enough to compensate for that. So then the only other way you do it is you tax more. And that could result in quite subdued economic activity. Look, I'm not a proponent to say this will be another global financial crisis and the world will collapse and the banks will collapse and we'll experience what we did in 2008, because I don't think you just hit a wall with this. I think it's a gradual process, you know, where government just looks and says, hey, we cannot, you know, our interest bill has gone up 30%, you know, in the last 2 years. And instead of looking at a deficit to GDP of 3%, we're now looking at 4.5%. We've got to up taxes. So I think it's a gradual approach. I don't think it's going to resolve in an absolute crisis.
But I think it's going
to be a severe dampening on economic activity for a sustained time period.
Different countries will have different approaches to this, of course. In South Africa, you can't raise taxes because the tax base is so tiny and shrinking all the time.
Yeah.
in the United States and in Europe, billionaires and the very, very, very rich, despite the fact that their accountants and their bean counters will say, OK, well, we can get out of this. We're not going to say that we're worth $200 billion because the $200 billion is not realised. It's in stock and everything else.
Yeah.
But they can take another couple of percent from them and pay for this deficit of which you speak. But emerging markets, they can't do that.
The super rich people, a couple of percent won't be enough. I mean, this is truly large. This is true. This is serious cashless. I mean, the wealthy people in the world, their combined wealth pales into insignificance in comparison to this.
Mm.
So I think this will be a dampener on growth. Now, the other negative side is if it's a dampener on growth, the stock market can come off because the stock market is the present value of future profits. And if future profits are dented because of higher taxes and less consumption because of higher taxes, the stock market can come down. Look, this is not happening tomorrow. And I want to emphasize that. And I think it will be gradual.
Please not tomorrow, yeah.
But I think where we sit today and look back specifically in global markets, the last 10, 12 years, in 50 years' time when you and I are both long gone, people are going to say, wow, 50. Look at that market. Wow. It would be like the 60s. You know, the 60s happened in South Africa. It was too fantastic. Our market shot the lights out, mainly in the back of gold. But nevertheless, the market shot the lights out. And then we had to wait until the Chinese years in 2002 before we had another market that was similar to the 60s. So you had to wait 40 years for that to come back. And that might very well be the case now, that the fantastic returns that we continue to have now, because, I mean, last night was the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 hit a record high.
Five times in a row, actually. Five trading days in a row, which is extraordinary.
Yeah. So people are going to look back and say, wow, weren't those years? Those years must have been fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the other casualty of all of this will be the long bond itself. Because, you know, the rate will probably, I think they're going down in the shorter term. When I say shorter term, it's even 10 years. You know, the longer term trajectory must be up because people are going to demand more return for the higher risk that they're taking because government's deficits will start going up and up and up. So, yeah, as I said, I don't think I will be managing money when this occurs, thank goodness. But I think this is the next big crisis. This is the next thing that people will be talking about.
All right. Well, as you say, it's not going to be your problem. It's not going to be my problem. You're not going to be managing money. I'm not going to be commenting upon you managing money. And, maybe medical science will advance so much, Wayne, that we'll be sitting watching, you'll be watching rugby, I'll be watching football. But it seems unlikely.
I often hear people talking on, you know, radio and TV of, and they get special awards when they turn 100 or 104.
No, I don't think
I want to live that long.
No, I definitely don't. I want you to, but I don't want to.
I don't think I want to. I don't think so, no.
I don't want to be sitting in a chair with a Norwegian nurse dabbing the drool out of the side of my mouth. I mean, it sounds attractive now, but in 20 years' time, not really. I'd rather withdraw gracefully. It's like men that do something with their hair. They go to clinics and things and get plugs put in. No, I don't want that. I'm just going to go and withdraw.
As an older person, said to me once, a person I really respect.
Yeah,
they said there's no dignity in growing old.
No, it's horrible.
There's nothing dignified about it.
No.
But that's life. It's fine. There are some advantages about getting old, is that you don't have to look cool anymore.
Yeah, but you see, you can look cool.
The latest fashion, the latest. Luke Shapiro still tries to look cool.
Yeah, I know, but you know, does he manage it really? Yeah.
No, I think he does. He's quite a natty dresser, Shapiro. I think Shapiro probably does look cool, but the point is, unless you're Shapiro, I don't think the nice thing about growing old is that you just don't worry about it anymore. You don't have to have the latest cell phones and the latest sneakers and the modern jeans, and you just don't care.
But you see, what you do, Wayne,
it's quite relieving. You know, it's actually quite liberating.
You don't wear young fashion when you're older. You wear older fashion. It's like being, if you look at old episodes of Downton Abbey, for example, you wear tweed jackets in winter and
I don't wear tweed jackets and corduroys.
Oh, here we go.
You will never see me in a tweed jacket and corduroys. Okay. You will never see me in a three-piece suit, even though three-piece suits was big when I was sort of 80s and 90s. Three-piece suits were huge. You only own three-piece suits. You're never going to see, as you well know, I shop at Macro and Pick and Pay.
That's the whole point. I mean, I must admit, if you wore a pair of jeans that were modern ones, not drainpipe jeans, as they used to call them in the 1950s.
Yeah.
If they're not skinny jeans, and if you wear a pair of jeans that are loose fitting, a decent jacket, and a lovely shirt with a decent collar, etc., and stride out in a pair of, I don't know, whatever shoes, a pair of loafers or something, I think you could cut a dash. I think you could be quite dashing. You don't have to look particularly modern. But to go out in a Pick and Pay, I'm not, nothing against Pick and Pay, but if you go out in those Pick and Pay clothes, I think you've given up.
I only ever go out in Pick and Pay clothing because that's all I own, Pick and Pay and Macro. It's the only clothes I own. I mean, I've got a couple of suits, obviously, which don't come from Pick and Pay clothing.
No.
But every day when I open up my cupboard, I look at my tie selection lurking in the back of my cupboard there.
Yeah.
I don't think I'll ever wear a tie again in my life.
Nor me. Unless I go and get my MBE or something from the King. I agree with you. Actually,
the world's biggest rugby fan more than likely is going to her. We're going to her graduation ceremony next year in Cumbria in England.
Very nice.
I might have to wear a suit and tie, or I might wear a suit and tie for that occasion. Yeah. I don't know what the dress.
Well, the dress code is certainly not Pick and Pay clothing. That's what I will tell you.
No, it won't be Pick and Pay clothing.
No, exactly.
Okay. It won't be Pick and Pay clothing.
All right.
I might still don a tie again once more in my life. I mean, I still wear suits now, you know, when I do work functions and that.
Mm.
But even then, most of the time I would wear a pair of chinos and a blue shirt. You know, I wouldn't actually
put
a suit on. Yeah, no, it's okay. I mean, and I'm quite happy about the sort of the casualization of work. I can remember when I first came up to Johannesburg and I worked for Momentum. Now, I worked for a company called LifeGrow when I came up to Johannesburg, and then Momentum bought LifeGrow. So my first introduction to Momentum coming from LifeGrow, and LifeGrow was south of the Yuxke. Obviously, Momentum was north of the Yuxke. When you went in to go see your boss, you had to put a jacket on. I mean, you always wore a tie. Mm. Everyone wore ties, but you had to put your jacket on. Mm. You weren't allowed to go into the boss's office without a jacket on. I'm quite happy about the casualization. And it's not just the casualization of clothes. I think the whole corporate environment is significantly better than in the 80s and I suppose only maybe the 90s, certainly the 80s and maybe the 90s, because there the big people were important. The Eugene Van Us, the Julian Ogilvie Thompson, you know, the big tough guys.
Yeah.
They ran companies in those days. You know, I'm not saying they ran the companies well, but they were the big tough guys, and what they said went. You didn't query what they said. You didn't argue. You didn't, you know, corporate culture is very different nowadays. I mean, I'm certainly feel quite relaxed to have an argument with my boss. It's because that's what hopefully you get a better result from that. But the 70s and the 80s, 70s, 80s and 90s, it was the big personalities that were the bosses.
I started in financial services in London in the mid to late 1980s, and I wore suits. And I must admit, Wayne, without being vain, I look really good in a suit. And women, who obviously at that age you were trying to attract women, women love you in a suit and tie. You really do look like you sort of stand out. And so I had about 7-8 suits of different stripes and colours and everything else, and wonderful shirts from Jermyn Street, etc., and ties from Savile Row, all that sort of thing. But you said you've got some suits now. Do they still fit you?
Yes, surprisingly enough, they do.
That's nice.
So surprisingly enough, look, they're not that old, the suits. I bought them, my latest suit I bought just after COVID ended because I thought I would need, that we would be back in suits and going back to work.
Mm.
So, yeah, surprisingly enough, my suits actually still fit me. The pants certainly fit well. Maybe the top, the buttons look a little bit stretched when you close them, a little stretched because, you know, the problem with suits.
Yes.
Is when they hang up in your cupboard for a couple of years, they shrink.
Why?
I've got no idea why they shrink, but when they're in your cupboard for a couple of years and you put them on again, they've somehow shrunk.
Yes, you see.
Now, it must be the manufacturing process the linen and the fabric, you know, just after 5 or 6 years,
The
damn things shrink.
I put on
it's actually very annoying.
It's very annoying. I put on a top the other day. Because, you know, it's summer in the Netherlands, it is actually winter in South Africa. I put on this top while I was watching a football match, and I thought, hello, this top's shrunk. And I thought, this blasted washing
machine.
This washing machine is shrinking my clothes.
Yeah.
And I couldn't.
It's shrinking your clothes.
I couldn't zip it up. And I thought, yes.
And somehow it doesn't shrink your pants because your pants start falling off your ass.
Yes, exactly.
As you get older.
Yes, because your stomach pushes it down.
Wearing, you've got to keep buckling them up tighter, your belt, because otherwise your pants fall off your ass, because somehow your bum disappears as your stomach gets larger.
It's a cruel trick that nature has played on us. Certain things get smaller, certain things get bigger, certain things stop working, certain things start working more than they should do. It's terrible. But washing machines and wardrobes and dry cleaners. I don't know. When we normally,
I think it's actually a conspiracy. Mm. So that you're forced to go out and buy new clothes.
I think so too. I think these.
So I think they. I think it's in the manufacturing bases. In the manufacturing bases.
Yes.
We just don't know about it. They actually make them where they actually shrink over time.
Okay, very good. This is one thing I want to say now. Normally we talk about food, but because you've gone on this clothing and appearance trip that you've been on. You and your partner, the world's biggest rugby fan, have been watching rugby, and she must be ecstatic every weekend with the Springboks playing even in that silly kit that they wear now, not the green. They wore some very, I don't know.
Yeah, it's like very pastel colour.
Very anemic-looking thing against Ireland on Saturday, which was a great game, by the way. I did watch the highlights. But I, of course, am a football fan, and I'm in Europe. And tonight, living in the Netherlands and being an Englishman, it's very difficult because the Netherlands are playing England in the semi-final of the Euros tonight, and I've decided to have bangers and mash. I've got to be English, so I'm cooking bangers and mash.
Oh, bangers and mash is good.
You've no idea. I've got these sausages that I bought from my butcher. He makes them himself. It's pure pork. There's no cereal in it. It's got some herbs and a bit of fennel in it and everything else. And I'll cook them gently. Sometimes you can overcook a sausage, but I don't. And the mash, it's a big process. Obviously peeled beautiful potatoes that I choose from my local greengrocer, not from the supermarket, wrapped in plastic, and I do all that. I smash it first of all with the potato smasher, then I add olive oil, butter, and right at the end cream, and then I whisk it, and it's so creamy and beautiful. And then you've obviously got the sausages on the side, but the key to it, Wayne, is 3 onions in a pan, 2 sweet red onions and 1 brown onion, just to give it a bit of a tang. And I caramelize the onions for about 20-25 minutes. Then I add stock and cook it even more. And then at the end, the key thing, and this is my secret, that is a big spoonful of Bovril. I don't know if you're familiar with Bovril.
Yes, very much so.
And that, when you put that on the side and scoop a bit of it on the mash.
Delicious.
Oh, of course. That's me tonight.
Surprisingly enough, that was going to be my food story as well.
What? Bangers and mash?
Biggest made us bangers and mash on Monday on Monday night.
Fantastic. And what a coincidence.
She also cut up the onions, fried them nicely, made a lovely sauce and gravy, not with Bovril. I must chat to her about that.
I didn't know about that.
Mm-hmm. But she made a lovely gravy, and we had bangers and mash, and they were absolutely delicious.
Sometimes only bangers and mash will do. Okay.
No, bangers and mash, it's very, very good, actually. It's a nice meal. And then the best thing about bangers and mash is you always make sure there's some bangers left over for the next morning.
Yeah, or at 3 o'clock in the morning when always you get up and you've got a bit of a hunger and you just go into that and you eat them cold.
Always make sure.
Yeah, exactly. Brilliant.
It's like cooking lamb chops. You've always got to make sure there's a lamb chop or two left over for the next morning.
Hopefully, Wayne, your bosses at First Rand are not listening to this, but thank you very much for a very illuminating chat about boring markets, but very exciting clothing and food tips. Wayne McCurry is a portfolio manager at F&B Wealth and Investment, and that was Wayne on Wednesday. The views and opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of Lindsay Williams and various contributors and do not reflect the policy, position, or opinion of any other agency, organization, employer, or company associated with strictlybusinesspodcast.com. Assumptions made on the analyses are not reflective of the position of any other entity other than the speaker or the author. And since we are critically thinking human beings, these views are always subject to change, revision, and rethinking at any time. Please do not hold us to them in perpetuity.